So I'm going to do the introduction sort of the opposite way that, Mark did. Mark writes amazing introductions, so I'll just suck it up and throw mine out there. So I'll begin with the facts and then move to the anecdote. Because we're anecdotal at heart, aren't we? So, after receiving his BA in English from Pomona College, an MA in English from Claremont Graduate School, this is all my landscape, Bruce and I grew up in the same part of the world, and then a master's in music performance from the Vermont School of Music, Bruce Bond worked for many years as a classical and jazz guitarist, and then he went to get his PhD in English. And since that time, he's taught all over the place, but most recently at the University of North Texas, where he is Regents Professor of English. And it sounds like the voice of sanity in this department, which is not a role I play. So his many collections of poetry include Choir of the Wells, which is actually, this sort of is intimidating, it's a tetralogy of new books. It's coming out next year. So there's four books in this one book. The Visible, which came out this year, Peel, Blind Rain, Cinder, The Throats of Narcissus, Radiography, The Anteroom of Paradise, and Independence Days. He's a very prolific poet. His poetry has appeared in Best American Poetry, the Yale Review, the Georgia Review, Raritan, the New Republic, the Virginia Quarterly, Poetry, all the places that you and I want to be. And he's received a ton of awards, including teaching awards, fellowships from the NEA and the Texas Commission on the Arts, a fellowship from Bread Loaf, which is where he and I met. And his poems, individual poems, have received attention from the Milton Dorfman Prize, the Greensboro Review Literary Award. Anyways, this gets tiring because it's just not fair. Anyways, he's at University of North Texas now. Are you still poetry editor of American Literary Review?
Of course.
Good. So he's one of the poetry editors at the American Literary Review. Now, about his most recent book, The Visible, the poet B.H. Fairchild has said, Bruce Bond enables us to see. He is as fully and brilliantly a poet as anyone currently writing, and The Visible is not only a major achievement, but I suspect a lasting one. See, that was from B.H. Fairchild, and we would all like Fairchild to say something like that about us, and so I wanted to make sure you heard it. Now, there's two anecdotes, actually. One isn't all that important, it's just weird, and that's that Bruce and I went to the same high school. There's just no chance in hell that two poets came out of that place. We were talking about that at dinner.
David Lee Roth.
David Lee Roth. Also came out of that. Eddie Van Halen didn't quite make it to the high school. But he was lurking in the locker room. So it was a very interesting place. But a few months ago, at the AWB conference in Chicago, Bruce and I actually sat down next to each other at a restaurant, and then, not knowing the other was there, and spent a couple of hours catching up and telling stories. And one story I told him at the time, and was probably reminded of the story by him, by his presence. And I'm realizing that the syntax of this sentence is going to screw that all up. But anyways, the story was about a notoriously pompous poet we both know. And Stephen knows, and Michael knows. And anyways, and I won't say who later on. Who once said, anyways, this poet, larger than everything in life, once said to me that, quote, elegance is a sort of bourgeois indulgence that has no place in poetry, that it somehow cheapens subject matter and privileges beauty over meaning. He said this to me while discussing my poem in a workshop. I thought Bruce would help me come to terms with that after 20 years, and he did. I think Bruce's work will speak quite clearly for itself here in a second, but it strikes me that there are very few poets who have refuted such nonsense so effectively and consistently. Beauty may not be the point of a Bruce Bond poem, but it is so certainly the result that it is very difficult to imagine separating an engagement with content from the power of language to transform and ennoble content, to make meaning an activity of the imagination and a product of formal precision and a love for the solacing power of poetry. Bruce Bond's poems are beautiful, and they're also deeply and sustainably meaningful. So please welcome Bruce Bond.
That was terrific, by the way. I loved every poem. I mean, they're really sculpted, they're beautiful poems. I'm honored to be here. Okay, I'm going to read all new work. There are just a couple of poems here that are in the book that came out this year, but there are several books. I've got two books coming out, and others kind of in the works. And these first two are from a book entitled For the Lost Cathedral. The Gate. When I first came into the world, I wept at the sting of light and steel that cut me as I gasped. The black rain kindled a quiet fire in the window, and I listened to a distance that had no language. That was the 50s, when Asia slept beneath a drizzle of ash that had been falling since the war. When I first learned of heaven, it was something we lost, or was lost simply the word we gave it. When I heard my nation's stories, they were the words of a father who gave me words. I was what I feared. If there is a pearl gate up there, I see it as a guillotine that chooses its friends carefully. The eye of the needle, the narrow passage, they would straighten us. The sound of rain would make us open. Advent. On an island in the disputed region of the Yellow Sea, blooms of smoke from the shelling of the garrison weave into one bloom. One force of nature so thick, they say, you cannot see your hands. The planet, we know, tilts on its axis like a man contemplating a problem, spun toward the horizon of another year, always forward, across a winter, where we celebrate an advent so long past, it could have been most any season. Islanders will tell you, the farther back you go, the more it dims into a future. The one we carry like a grudge or gift to lay at the threshold of a child's bed. Nights when the cold draws its curtain on our homes, we turn to the windows of TVs and stare alone with the war and its commercials, the firestorm that breaks some other land in two like bread. We too break, each year a little more divided at heart as we cough by the fire, still and sleepy as cows in the crush, thinking it is one thing for a king to kneel, another for him to seek advice. The modern kings do not wander far into the desert, but tend to sit and watch the monitors fill up with falling lights. Facts are hard. Like the man who buries his hatchet in the turkey he shares with a neighbor, the talk that turns bitter as it grows more national in scope. Say, I am the offspring of the thought I just had, flesh of its flesh, and so different, in some measure culpable, free, as anything alive. A child is born crowned in blood, and we lighten up, sure. We see it every day, and yet this day, tradition says, is unlike any, which is true. It has never happened and never will again. Over and over, the will to be reborn, to gasp and cry forgiveness, that is, like birth, difficult, scared, insurgent, brave with the stranger, the winter child that blossoms through the wound. I guess I just got one from the big book I mentioned, The Choir of the Wells. This one's called Ink, and it's about the sacking of Baghdad. It happened in the 12th century. The Mongols took the city, and they dumped the books into the river because they wanted to construct a bridge with the books. And this is the finest library. Well, it rivaled the Alexandria Library. At that time, it was the finest in the world. And it contained a section of the library called the House of Wisdom, which had a lot of illuminated books. And they were lost that day. So you'll learn more as I read the poem. This is called Ink. When, in the dark ages of the East, the Mongols took the heart of the city and poured in room after room to cut a path through the bodies in their way. They loaded up the illuminated books, the many wildflowers of Islam, hand-sewn, penned, edged in gold, and made of them a bridge across the Tigris, shaky at best, to lead men from the spoils of their labor. This is the story of the House of Wisdom. House centuries there gathered to pool the gems of medicine and metaphysics until the river took them, leaving us the ache of knowing just enough to ache. If history repeats, it does so without us. It returns the way a criminal returns, or a tongue to the space that was a tooth. When the bodies of the philosophers broke the surface, they floated here and there, littering the shore, their wounds drained into the current to stain the glass, not red exactly, in spite of what you hear, but rust, a fading scar of dirt and iron. The greatness of a city is how it kneels near the water, to beat its laundry there, or flood the fields in their season, to carry what? Fennel, flax, cinnamon, a scholar. Beyond the necessary, a river draws the mourner toward something she cannot find. It helps her nonetheless. Or the believer toward reconciliation with her God. If we hear their rumors of water going on without end, it is nonetheless loss that speaks. What book would not be a bridge? Or the grave of some sad misconception? Somewhere still, there is a volume that says what the river of the dead cannot, that once a library fell into the Tigris, and these waters that are a widow's friend ran black with ink, mile after mile. It'll sun up later, in the dark, clouds will part, and then just as you're leaving, I'll bum you out. No, it actually didn't. But I did a book with a painter named Aaron Wiesenfeld, great painter. His paintings are kind of disturbing, and I own three of them. And I have them in my room. My wife thinks I'm kind of crazy. My one's of a spirit or ghost walking in this room. I love that book. But he does very evocative paintings that focus, you know, kind of difficult tensions. And they suggest narrative, but not too clearly. They're mysterious, and I absolutely adore them. I can't imagine working with another painter and being able to do a whole book. He's just, there is a kind of focus to his thematic preoccupations, but there's also a lot of variety in it. Well, anyway, the most controversial of his paintings is a painting of a girl who's committed suicide. She's hung herself in a tree, and it's this gorgeous winter scene. He said he put that on his Facebook page and got a lot of angry comments, as you can imagine. So I think he was wondering whether we should put this painting in the book. It's so controversial, which is precisely why I wanted to do it. I mean, I wanted to write about it and write against it in some ways, because it provoked so many interesting questions about the relationship between art and suffering. So all the poems in that book are titled after the paintings. I mean, they borrow the paintings' titles. So this one's called Sea of Trees. Silence is half the music. The song breathes. Winter chimes go still inside the trees. And the hole in the music is musical. because, oddly, it lets in what music is not. Not alone. The stray hop, the closing door. Silence is one half merciful, the other the careless snowfall of the world. I do not feel what you feel. I cannot sing my way into your child's suffering. I try, and the music of trying goes speechless in the woods between us. Let me try again. Once there was a girl who climbed a tree to end her misery, to hang among the branches like a bell. Pain is pain. It is not beautiful. What we do not know about her life fills the forest with a light blue mist. So why look, you ask? Is it her there? Or is it your heartbreak that is a shade cruel, not knowing what it is you break for? Pain is not the music of pain, not love, though it may find comfort in the light blue distance. I know from experience this is not always true. Nerves go raw, too raw for the quietest of breezes. Would it have mattered if the song were sad, if it were less the theater of sadness? The sandal that slipped from her dangling foot, its needle of endearment, does it charm? Does it paralyze love's will a little? Half a girl in pain is our deafness to pain. Unlike the deafness of the trees in winter, we pretend, we try, we commit our gaffes at the funeral reception, and the mother crumples into tears. It is our innocence that makes mistakes, that makes us feel more cautious and ashamed. Is it better to look or not look, or to desecrate the season? True, in turning away, we turn into something. What would comfort a lost innocent more? Or is that the question? Is it not the mother we should worry about now? Is it not the blue gem of love she offered? Is it not the sweet song she sang her child to make night safe for sleeping once again? Okay, I have a couple sonnets here. I've got a book of sonnets called Black Anthem. I'm just kind of holding on to. First one's called Whitman. The arguments for the existence of God do not exist. Any God will tell you. We get allegiance to the same blood that floods the iris when it closes. True. A bird might call you in the lost tongue of your birth, pour its brief clean through the hole that is its memory, its song. It knows the heart that has no heart to argue. It sings, if it sings, in the cardinal key of the garden, or in the dark whisper of the soldier who lies still, his body warm with morphine as you kneel to hear him breathe, to take down his final story. Dear God, if you are there, believe in me. The irrevocable. And as he spoke of the great illusion out of which a world appears, I thought of something my mom said about pain, how it is the one God we cannot doubt. And so, for her poor body's sake, I asked the guy, please, sir, can you spare a hand? And he agreed, cutting through his wrist, and he continued, deep in theory, blind with light. And so I asked for his eyes, who wouldn't, which he gave, without a break in the stride of talk, although his body left us bone by bone and all went dark, his chair, his voice, his oracle, and me nodding, a child of what I could not see. Okay, these are from the new book, The Visible. This one's called People. In the land of People magazine, Tara Reid is having a hard day. It's your body again. too fat, too thin, too much of a body to fit into our imago of the prurient angel perpetually young. Here and there, the combustible cameras go on and off like fireflies that hover in the dark wood. You see them burn inside the startle of her gaze. I want to say, get a life. But then, it is me who is reading People magazine. So many aging starlets, so many bright white shores littered with the exiles of heaven. Oh my God, we just spilled water all over my foot. Littered with the exiles of heaven. With the desert palms and lemon trees that bend with ripened fruit. I look up from the page, and it's my turn in the chair at the dentist's office. My brain gone gray as the tooth I came with. The large one she scrapes like a skeptic at a hieroglyphic. It's nothing, not yet, she says. Only the seed of the filling shining through. And then there's the root of another one, exposed. The way Tara was. That night her breast slipped out of her drunken joy. Drunken, yes, but joy. Were this the heart of April, I might hardly notice the cobalt blue of morning. Hallelujah, say the barren limbs that point every way but down. Tara Reed, chirped the dusty spiders. And who would shame the shameless of their joy? It makes us feel like gods again. The deeper our indulgence, the more we turn the smooth complexion of the pages. Why pair the lives of stars until their bodies collide with insomnia and pills, with all the bright white teeth of sexual revenge? The gods know a good disaster when they see one, the kind that scandalizes a goddess, that roots her to the common ground. So it is when the divine mingle with blood and boredom. They too need a story to keep the cameras fluttering their eyes. Another Tara sits at her dresser brushing a bee from the lid of her wine. She suffers the silences of rooms inside of rooms, like us. Another god seed enters the human, the way we in turn enter theaters, the way the mind enters the hole at the end of a life. Only a dark like this knows what it is to turn gray and fester, to bear the beam of hope we shed not far, but far enough. One story bleeds into another, cut, a wrap, and she exits the scene, taking with her a bottle of something disgraceful, something we cannot see, no one does, not now, not ever. She opens her mouth, we open. Some silences are so thick, they touch everything, like the air that touches the objects in a room. Something kisses her lips. She swallows. We swallow. And then she turns away, taking with her the need for some last privacy and exposure all at once. If not youth, then abandon. If not wisdom, than mystery, which is a kind of youth. The common birds sing their December music. They sprinkle the sound like water in the hand of a priest, in fear and joy, or both at once. Who are you to know, they say, and no one answers. Who are you, they sing, and will not stop.
I think that was your water.
Sorry, I saved it for you.
Okay, we're nearing the end. All right, I'm going to read a few from a book I'm working on, Words Written Against the Walls of the City, and then. If there's time, just a short one that I often end with. This is called Easter. Whatever inspired that first live cell to pull a little line down the center and so become as to both and neither, it must have known what a child knows when he looks up at a house on fire until, ascending, the night is day again. When I was his age, I put my ear against the train tracks to hear the future. It sounded like a metal it was made of. Everything I love died with music. Be fruitful and multiply, said one future. Seeing off in the distance cut both ways, I learned to survive in light of it. I learned to long to survive myself. Ear to the steel, I felt the cold expire. I learned the moan of the locomotive carries better after dark. I lay awake each night waiting, waiting, and then I fell. I do not know when I first began to love, though I suspect long before I knew a thing about it. The future says, in the beginning, there were two boys. There was skin, one side of which was fire. One boy stepped from the flames of the other, paused, scared, looked back. Let us call him Knowledge, the boy who left his body to burn. Let us give the suffering his solitary name. The invention of this cry track. Actually, this was inspired by my student who wrote this great poem about laugh tracks. I thought, why the hell isn't there a cry track? I don't get it. So I wrote this, The Invention of the Cry Track. Long after the laugh track, it seemed only rational, practical, this new thing. Not because we were too stupid to know what was sad, but because, as in the logic of the canned guffaw, the producers knew something about us we did not, or did and did not let the others know, that we were lonely, that we wanted to join in the misery, and weeping just felt right after a long day of wisecracks and meaningless tasks. Now, at last, the pretense of something more intimate, watery, sweet, taken to heart. And we wept not simply because we thought it important, but because the ghost clan of size was ours now, and the small boned phonograph of grief a warm thing. And we could cut loose of embarrassment, pretending to wipe our eyes because something was in them. Something really was. And we would never get it out entirely, never break down enough, never pluck the world from its cradle and be ourselves again. Okay, two more. Kind of a longish one, but really short one. It's called the two poem sort of notification. It always happens in readings for some reason. I don't understand it. Power of two. This is inspired by George Offen's poem of being numerous. I love that poem. And it's very much about the social self, you know, that we have this kind of multiplicity in us and that binds us to one another. There's a great line about Caruso. Caruso, we say, was rescued, so we have chosen. That gets quoted in here. It implies a bias. I love that line. So I was working with that and thinking about another model in a sense too. I probably brought to this some psychoanalysis, you know, in terms of complexes and what it is to be multiple people that, you know, aren't conversing very well. So I wanted to counterpoint that notion against Offen's and to talk about the moral self a little bit. So that's part of what's going on here. So it starts with an epigraph from George Offen. Obsessed, bewildered by the shipwreck of the singular, we have chosen the meaning of being numerous. Night loves a ladder. A heart is housed in one. Just this morning, I heard below me remnants of the whisper, the physical, the intellectual, the spiritual, ascending from the muck of who I was. When I was a boy, I stared into the rose of my cathedral. It was earth on fire from a distance. Pull yourself together, my father told me. And the words pulled me toward him. Intuition, I know, is not to be confused with desire. And yet, and so, it is. Truth cherishes no one. The lie, however, has favorites. The brain is made of them. Little mercies, islands, wounds. I know a woman who is so many people, they cannot know one another. They cannot know you. Sleep is just one part of the story talking to another, and only sometimes with anything to say. This gut feeling, is it wisdom or a symptom or both? Dreams sleep lightly, if at all. Faces tear away from them. When I first stood up, I became a line standing on a circle, just like a line to love a circle, bloodline, family circle. In my city, people gather at the fountain. Water pours without end. It makes me drowsy. It makes me say the things I never had the heart to say. Eyes close and the darkness opens. To judge what is not quite seen is never to see it. The hubris of shame says, divide, divide. Anxiety breaks its puzzle into small and smaller pieces as if that were one way to solve it. The world, thank heaven, is bigger than we think. The seen bigger than the eye it sees. My father sketched a tree and named it Us. Late at night, it would grow beneath his research. He called his family his. The greater the tree, the more of death it swallowed. To make one, the number one, what could be more serene, more horrific? The burden of knowing is never knowing enough. As a boy, I loved to separate the gears of a thing to see it, blind to what it was. A bug, a watch, a conscience. Hell was the prospect of putting it back together. I'd like to be apart from things as law is from the father from the criminal. High in the thought balloon above the body, I pried open the cage of the heart, then stopped to watch a while to see it labor. So far away, this cortex, this sad bag with an animal inside. Shadows cast the shadows of our moral pride. Admit it, isn't the devil a little boring? Those who would cozy up to cruelty, is it not a little sentimental? He does not cozy. He has no friend. He cannot be broken like bread. He divides the shipwreck of the singular is the shipwreck of the numerous. A junkie makes his connection and the valves of attention open, drowned in blood. He is alone among the others whose bliss makes them more sweetly brief, more distant. Crusoe, we say, was rescued, so we have chosen. Or did some other choose? I know people who talk to themselves in their sleep, who again and again refuse to listen. Once I cut a frog to see what was inside, in the tiny bowl of flesh, a measure of light. It ached the way light does, not because I made it ache, me or some other law. My father too cut me now and then. He opened up my chest to lie down in the grave he made. He taught me light is fast, and time does not heal all wounds, only the open ones. At night, I close the black jacket of my gospel and say, well, what I do know is this. Each morning, a city wakes me from within. The shooting galleries of dream moan in the distance. The words they break, they mend and mend again. The body forgets nothing. It is not alone. It is a language for alone. It speaks to itself so that it might be one among the others. so that it might emerge. It leaves for no one. Father, in your city, are you listening? Planetarium. As the mobile planets wheeled over my crib, their shadows darkened the yellow walls. A ripening pear. My mother frowned tenderly like a mirror, touched her fingers to her nipple, placing there the word milk, then took her hand away. The syllable drifted to the floor of my body, a shiny lure swiveling through the dark. My first imagination of need. A toy piano played lullabies on its metal teeth. When my mother leaned down to kiss me, she pressed her face on the pad of my silence. Then she withdrew, jostling the planets. That night, my parents slept lightly. The sky lay wind-stripped and polished with tar. When I spoke, they imagined themselves emerging in my first words, like children. They lit up at the names they were given.